Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagram Radian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now for one of our conversations with leading strategists and thinkers is a legendary entrepreneur, Silicon Valley pioneer, and proud United States Air Force veteran, Steve Blank, who founded the KNS Ranch and who is an adjunct professor with the Department of Management and Engineering at Stanford University. He's been a bipartisan advisor to numerous U.S. administrations, either directly or through advisory boards, recently resigning from the Defense Business Board. Over the course of 21 years, he launched 8 startups, 4 IPOs, and 2 that cratered so badly that he, in his own words, maintains that they have their own Iridium layer. Steve founded the Lean Startup methodology to allow companies to launch and grow more economically and faster than ever by being better focused on hard problems customers want to solve, an approach that he and his co-conspirators, Joe Felter and Raj Shah, say can be directly applied to government and the Pentagon. This conversation is part of a series of strategy conversations sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, the late Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. Steve, thanks very much for joining us. And it's always a pleasure welcoming a fellow Manhattanite to the program.
Thanks for having me. Honored to be here.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. I know I've asked you this question before, but do the two iridium layered craters have names?
They do. One was called Ardent, and the other, ironically, was called Rocket Science. and at least in my career, you know, out of the failures came some real insights, which actually changed how startups are built and how the government commercializes science in the United States. Though if anybody tells you failure is fine, they've never failed, at least at scale before, right, and had to lay off hundreds or thousands of people. But learning from failure is actually the goal. Failing is not the goal.
Right. Well, as you've said, right, Ardent, and I remember this because I was a computer savvy at an early age, you know, and would, you know, in 1978, remember going to the punch card computer at Hunter College as somebody who went to Hunter College High School. And I remember that the Titan computer was going to be the big thing, right? And wasn't that an Ardent product? Was the Titan computer?
It was, and it turned out to be the intersection of the null set, meaning we built a great machine, kind of, but it missed the markets it was targeted at, and that happens. And in fact, that's the nature of innovation entrepreneurship. You know, people on the inside of the DoD kind of forget or maybe never understood that Silicon Valley is actually a funnel of activities, not a pipeline, but a funnel. You know, for every 100 or thousands of startups that begin, you know, the few that you read about in the newspaper or press or becoming unicorns or look at that, they've made millions or billions of dollars. There have been hundreds or thousands of things that, you know, are still sitting in their mother's basement. And that is the nature of the process, which is why, you know, the startups are not large companies or government agencies, but more importantly, government agencies are not, or nor can they be, or should be, startups, and trying to directly apply those principles is usually a pretty fatal mistake on both ends.
You know, it's kind of funny you say that, because that's kind of been my sense for a long time. And one of the things, before we get into the conversation, sort of get your take on this, right? Is Silicon Valley about technological innovation or as much about business model innovation, right? I mean, time and again, Silicon Valley may use actually existing technologies that allow you to do things differently, right? Or solve problems that you've had, but you didn't know you had. So how much of this is sort of reinventing the business model as opposed to technology, which was what we associate with it?
Yeah, I'd say maybe none of the above. I think Silicon Valley is about if you go back to the comments I made earlier about failure, Silicon Valley is about a culture that embraces learning and discovery rapidly, and has figured out how to make enormous sums of money in doing so. It's driven by greed. And when I say that, I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but you know, when you just look at Silicon Valley as the entrepreneurs, that's like looking at one hand clapping. Silicon Valley and entrepreneurial clusters are driven by crazy people who are funded by equally crazy people who have figured out that you could actually make money by going to Las Vegas here. It is not like putting your money in the bank. It's figuring out which of those hundred or thousands of crazy people are actually going to make something that will scale beyond all imagination. Right. And that's an innovation ecosystem. As I said, that's a completely different model than what we have to do in the DoD, where we have to be reliable and repeatable, and we have 2 million people to manage, et cetera. And normally can't take those kinds of risks, nor can we have those kinds of people, at least as our core. We need repeatable and scalable processes that could be managed at scale. That's a very different ecosystem that we built. But in fact, it's been very successful in making innovation happen at speed and scale that's not possible currently inside of large organizations, whether they're the government or large companies. And we could talk about that, about, so how do you, right. how do you integrate the two? I think it's the challenge that the DoD faces today, because our adversaries have figured that out. And that should scare the heck out of us.
Well, and so that's excellent queuing up, Steve. Thank you very much. So for the decades after World War II, we lived off the fat of the investment land, right? I mean, we had made a tremendous industrial investment. We made investment in technologies, and that held us through good stead. But your mentor, Bill Perry, even in the 1990s, was saying that the ecosystem is changing, that commercial industry will lead defense, that defense will have to change its acquisition processes to get that commercial innovation into the department, and also noted, as Andy Marshall, the namesake for this series, predicted, that all of these revolutions of the second offset strategy would actually be turned by our adversaries against us, right? Whether it was night vision or precision or GPS or what have you. And meanwhile, we were turning China into a closer trade partner. And last year, it was $650 billion trade relationship. And they took that money and they've turned it around to military capability with which to threaten us. Before we can fix this, folks in government and the Pentagon have to understand the nature of the ecosystem and how it's changed, right? At the end of the day, how has it changed? Because it's not clear, as you suggested, folks in the Pentagon and government fully understand how this ecosystem has changed. How's the ecosystem changed? And what are the dangerous myths about it that have to be dispelled?
Yeah, so let's go all the way back then. Since you started with history, let me at least give you my view of history, technology, DoD, et cetera. You know, in World War II, it was the first time the federal government ever engaged the civilians at scale in working on advanced weapon systems. That was called the OSR&D. 16 or 19 different major project areas, from radar, electronic warfare. There was a physics program that got spun out that had its results over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, called the Manhattan Project, but in fact made the federal government for the first time the full funding partner of universities, which continued past World War II, and it gave us the National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health, and all the other, and then our FFRDCs, all came out of that World War II activity. What also came out, and this is kind of leads us to today, is in the 1950s, the U.S. Was deep in the middle of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. At the same time, key idea, rapid technological changes were happening. We were going from piston planes to jets. We were going from conventional power to nuclear power. We were going from manned bombers to now we were considering ICBMs, intermediate range missiles, whole suite of technology, literally in the decade of the 50s, which just almost every month, year, et cetera, new things were now possible. And how that manifested itself in the DoD is, if you think about it, in the 50s, we had five series of the century series of fighters. I think there were five fighters, F-104, F-106, F-102. We had three generations of manned bombers, B-36, B-47, B-52. Navy had two or maybe three generations of carriers. We're talking about within a decade. And what we were doing is trying to literally, unintentionally, build disposable systems because we recognized that they would only last for a couple of years until better technology came about, and and boom. Well, by the time 1960 rolls around, you know, pretty obvious that the costs are out of control. While we were taking advantage of this stuff, it was basically uncapped spending. And so the Kennedy administration brought in Robert McNamara and the WizKids, and basically put in place, you know, this system we still use today, the, you know, the big acquisition system, you know, with GCIDS and the requirements.
PBS, right?
PBE and then DAS for acquisition. That is the intersection of those three circles that everybody joins, draws. That's basically this model to manage costs. And it's a big idea because it wasn't just to manage costs, is that McNamara realized by the 60s, us and the Soviet Union were kind of locked into this, you know, you get technology X and I get technology X and you get technology Y. And yeah, we were always looking for offset strategies, and Bill Perry's offset strategy and in the late 70s and early 80s got a stealth and ISR and precision strike. But essentially, we were able to do this kind of acquisition and planning and requirements and resourcing model because there were no huge technology surprises. We were constantly looking for them, but essentially that's where we were, and that's where we are today. And, you know, that all had kind of really interesting consequences. You know, we argue that we manage life cycle and dot MLPF and whatever and 30-year cycles, and, you know, carriers are 30 years and these bombers and the B-21s and what, and we do run these things that way. That's fine when there's essentially a status quo. And you know, when the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union collapsed, we were the unipower. I mean, there wasn't even anybody. And then to be honest, when we were competing with non-nation states, this truly wasn't even an issue. It's like, you know, ISIS didn't have carriers. I mean, you know, we had to relearn the lessons of Vietnam and asymmetric warfare, but the whole, where we were spending our major defense acquisition programs were still on these large systems. And I say all this, and most of your audience understands this and probably, you know, could quote me chapter and verse, but I at least want to set this as the preamble. So the world has just turned upside down and we haven't got the memo in the DOD. And here's the big idea. We're back to the 50s in that there's so much rapid technology change. It's changing yearly, but for the first time ever, it's not being driven by the DOD. That should make everybody like gasp and sit and think about that for a second. All the things the DOD now needs going forward, maybe with a few exceptions like nukes and possibly hypersonics, though that's going to change as well, are being driven by commercial companies. AI, machine learning, autonomy, cyber, robotics, you know, advanced biotech, you know, quantum. Make your list of warfighting technologies that need to be embedded in next generation weapon systems, which will give us new operational concepts. Most of them are being driven at their core, not the exquisite front end sensors or things we need, but the core technologies are no longer in our control. And that's new. Why? Well, remember that whole crazy ecosystem of Silicon Valley and Silicon Valley-like places? Those are what's generating these technology changes. And it so happens that, as I said, most of them are needed and necessary in future weapon systems, which will drive future concepts. But we don't have a process. Here's the big idea. And again, this gets us down to what problem do we face? Is that our entire requirements, resources, and acquisition system is built around the model where no, we could plan for 30-year cycles, and no, cost and MLPF, the tail is more important than the outcome. And there was nothing wrong with that. And by the way, none of your listeners should think I'm saying anybody's doing anything stupid. No, DOD has more smart people than every startup ecosystem that I've seen. It's just that the system as designed never even contemplated what's going on here. And it's not that we didn't make good efforts in the last couple of years to try to patch the system. But that is the problem. We haven't recognized right. that there needs to be a different system, not replacing. Big idea. We still need carriers for 30 years. We still need programs. We still need probably the requirements, resourcing, and acquisition systems as we have. But we need a different system for big idea to encapsulate and integrate external innovation in a size and scale that we haven't done for 75 years. Big idea. And I don't mean, let me just finish the sentence.
Sure.
And I don't mean kind of, gee, we finally figured out after 10 years of pissing contest how to get a SpaceX contract going. I mean, as a regular integrated process, then that external innovation is an integral part of what the DoD does. And that is definitely not the case.
So for decades, there are folks who've been, you know, pointing out, you know, China's rising as a threat, right? Their folks are being educated in Western universities. They're really getting good at this technology game. I remember just a couple of years ago, somebody senior from the Trump administration, told me, hey, we can contain these guys and we can force our allies to contain them. And that doesn't really work very well when China is the number one trading partner of some of our allies and partners. And then in the DoD side of the innovation sphere, Steve, right? I mean, there are folks who've been prophesizing this for a long time, that our own system is sort of choking ourselves at this point, right? We are trying to develop systems with a 50-year life expectancy, and some of them aren't 50-year weapons, right? I mean, to your point on fighters, you know, I don't need to tell you that because you were an avionics tech during the Vietnam War, serving in Thailand, and I want to get your sense on that in a minute. How do we... Right. Ash Carter tried to do this with his drill lecture to start sort of the outreach to Silicon Valley. We've got to fail and fail fast. Members of Congress say that all the time. They have absolutely no intention of spending a lot of money for failure when you really get down to it, because everybody wants to score political points. You, Joe Felter and Rod Shaw have been working on how to re-envision this system. And one of your great epiphanies really was that Silicon Valley companies fail because they actually don't think about the customer, right? The advantage of that is that at least it goes out of business before it does damage, whereas the Pentagon requirement system actually comes up with a stupid idea that it didn't talk to the customer about. And then the acquisition system actualizes something that actually takes money and resources away from stuff that you actually need. So as somebody, you know, you've looked at this problem, what are the big changes the system needs? Because my fear is that actually in a very short amount of time, the United States, right, time is your most important commodity. And after not addressing this for too long, you've now got to run two or three times faster just to stay in place, much less get ahead, right? What does the system need specifically, and how does it need to change to do what it is you know has to happen?
Wow, that's, that's a pretty long laundry list of things to change. I guess the first thing I would start by saying is, I don't think we need to throw out everything we have and everybody stop doing X and start doing Y. I always think those approaches are sometimes not productive. We do need the kind of systems we have for decision support, for requirements, resources, and acquisition, for the things that need to be under those, you know, current rules and regulations and processes. But as I said earlier, I think we need to think about what's the overlay. What's the additional system that allows us to fast track? And I don't mean, Eleanor did a good job of adding, defining those, what are the 5 or 6 acquisition tracks, and we now have a software track and whatever, mm-hmm. but they still don't solve the problem of, how do we actually, set up, alternate fleets or test, divisions or battalions or brigades to try out new concepts, not through 5-year processes, but how do we rapidly kind of deploy, test, learn, try something else to get back to that speed and urgency? I'm not suggesting the same system, but the speed and urgency that the U.S. actually was able to do in the 1950s. I mean, literally just imagine five generations of fighters, you know, three generations of aircraft carriers and manned bombers, just multiple generations of intermediate range and then ICBMs all at the same time. You know, and in fact, you go, whoa, that's not possible today, until you look at that's exactly what China is doing. I mean, look at their shipyards, look at their aircraft and what they're doing in space, and you find out that it is possible today. You know, you mentioned China. China has basically, you know, adopted what we did in the 50s, didn't have the burden of this McNamara-era decision support systems of requirements, resourcing, and acquisition, and basically built a system for speed and urgency, willing to throw away generations of systems as they learn. You know, one could argue we don't have the budget or the skill or whatever, but I would argue, no, what we have, and this is, again, another, without saying these are dumb or people making bad decisions, but we have 88 major defense acquisition programs, which take up 99.9% of our budget. You know, all of those backed by existing primes whose lobbying budget is probably bigger than one of those major weapon systems. And again, no nefarious things. It's how the system is set up. I should give you a sidebar, which I think is kind of funny and ironic. It's a, I don't know if your audience knows what the phrase "the Last Supper" means in the Pentagon. Do you know what that is?
I think they do know. I was one of the reporters who was covering the Last Supper reported that the Bill Perry was going to have this meeting with CEOs, and we were all trying to figure out what they discussed in the meeting.
Right. So, you know, for the three people in your audience who don't, it was that 1993 Pentagon dinner for the chiefs of the nation's biggest defense contractors. Les Aspin was then the SecDev, and Bill Perry was his deputy. You know, this was the wind down of the Cold War, and there wasn't going to be enough business for all these contractors. And they, you know, the SecDev looked at all of them and said, you know, some of you ain't going to be here next year. You know, you're either going to go out of business, but you should probably merge. So they kept on merging. And now, you know, almost three decades later, it sounded great. You know, okay, we'll reduce costs. But what we ended up with is that our defense industrial base for our most exquisite and critical acquisition programs, you know, have just one or maybe two suppliers. And what that means is we're left with a dilemma that when one of these major primes fail to deliver or deliver poorly, we can't fire them, or we can't even penalize them or say we're going to take our business elsewhere. That was an unexpected consequence. No one was being dumb. At least in the DOD, it sounded pretty logical. We'll eliminate competition, have one prime, we could give them all the business, and they will logically do, you know, the best for the country. Well, that's not how business works. They logically did what was best for their company and their shareholders. And that is, you know, we could look at Ford class carriers or KC-46s or, you know, go down the litany of things that are late or even starting late or starting whatever. There's no competition here. And by the way, if we were redoing this system or thinking about the system in the way I'm thinking about it is, you know, we got what we got. No one's going to replace Huntington Ingalls. We still will need carriers in some form in the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. But we should be thinking about, well, what other kind of ships or things in the water do we need? And how can we expand that industrial base? Well, if you're hunting in Ingalls, that's the worst thing you want to hear. But if you're in the Defense Department thinking about outcomes, of course, you want to kind of generate new classes of ships, whether they're UUVs or large, small, intermediate, et cetera, building prototypes, testing out new ideas, creating new shipyards, both in the U.S. and with our allies. And then thinking about them maybe with different life cycles, maybe given that how fast technology and concepts evolve, maybe we don't need 30-year life cycles. Maybe we should be building things for 5 or 10 years and thinking about recycling them. So I didn't mean to get us into that rat hole, but back to those primes. The other thing that's going on that is almost as important to as that 1993 dinner, except it's never been in a meeting, is that the business model that they so long built on, this idea of building hardware and then if you need a change, we're happy to build the next version for you, is being obsoleted and of course over their dead body. And that's the ability to upgrade software overnight. And in fact, that most of these platforms were in the 20th century, we used to bend sheet metal and software was an add-on. In the 21st century, these platforms are essentially software with hardware as an add-on. Well, if your business model is predicated on, no, I'll sell you the next generation of X, where in fact, in the commercial world, everything is a software upgrade, eventually that's going to collide. And your CFO is going to have his head exploding, that is your chief financial officer in one of these primes, when you can no longer underbid the first generation system and assume that your business model is predicated on making it up over time. But example. It's not, listen, no one's being evil here. They're all kind of optimizing their own interests. Some of these primes, right. Their technical prowess has declined because atrophy and new technologies moved on and it's no longer their core expertise. It's obviously they still are great at stuff. But in fact, for not almost every one of them, their core expertise certainly now is lobbying and legal departments. And that is not obviously in the interest of the country. It was okay when we had no near or peer competitors. And by the way, we use the word near peer competitors. And, I think that we do a disservice to the American people is that, for the first time ever, the homeland is under direct attack, whether it's cyber or within the reach of other activities. And in some areas, China, for sure, have surpassed us. And we've just not been honest with ourselves and DOD hasn't been honest with Congress. Because if we did that would force us to look at the budget we have and say, well, how do we allocate that to the things we really need going forward? And how do we build these systems that allow us to kind of integrate external activities, not as one-offs, but as an integral part of civil-military fusion like China's done? Where in China, it's not an option. In the United States, we need to build what I would call civil-military alliance rather than fusion. That is one that's not coercive, but profitable. Profitable for the commercial companies, but actually feeds at speed the innovations, both technology and ideas and people. We make it so hard for the people to kind of who want to serve to do that.
So I thought it was really interesting that many years ago when Saab was starting the development of their new version of the Gripen fighter, they basically made it like an iPad, right? That it's going to have software updates that will automatically go into the airplane and continuously update it. Because the point they were making was from a hardware standpoint, we're not advancing it that much. The whole thing is in the combat system and we're going to make it open architecture. So I did think, that there are some companies who are looking at that kind of an open model of doing things. But more interestingly, Steve, I mean, you hit the nail on the head in that we have to change both the national ecosystem and the Defense Department ecosystem, right? In terms of that kind of the righteous civil military fusion, which the Chinese rightfully are doing at the end of the day. But we find ourselves, we did DIUX and then we do AFWERX and SOFWERX and WorksWERX and whatever else. But at the end of the day, we're still not delivering that innovation and change at scale and speed, right? I mean, the United States developed the atom bomb, which you mentioned, that humble physics program. I mean, that was in 3 years. We did the ballistic missile submarine in 5. We put man on the moon in 8, right? So talk to us about how we get the civil military fusion model right and how we use your lean methodology and mindset to actually drive this process faster. And actually harness people's greed to deliver what we want them to deliver.
Yeah, it's very funny. You just mentioned a set of great activities that the DoD has done to try to accelerate innovation. And there's a list, a further list, right? And we've stood up strategic capabilities offices and rapid capabilities offices. And And during Iraq and Afghanistan, we Bruce Jetty and Pete Newell, et cetera, ran the rapid equipping forces for the Army. So it's not that we don't know how to stand these up and that everybody else is now, you know, discovering, hey, we could use an OTA and, you know, we could at least get something started. Those are all symptoms of very smart people in the DoD recognizing that our existing system isn't working for what we really need. But no one has really stepped back. And this is back to your point, that going, well, what should we do? And then the argument starts getting back, oh, we need a reform of the acquisition system. Well, that's been discussed since Washington didn't like the boat he had, you know, across the Delaware. The point I'm trying to make is, no, leave the damn system alone, because trying to reform the entire thing, it'll be a mistake. We need an overlay. We need an overlay for rapid integration and building the civil-military alliance that allows us to not only identify, you know, acquire, but then rapidly deploy systems as an overlay on top of existing organizations. Every service should have a rapid overlay of, you know, requirements, acquisition, and deployment, which is a different system out in the field. And of course, your maintenance and policy people, oh, we can't do 30-year life cycle and doctrine and whatever. Yes, there needs to be an overlay of chaos on top of the existing execution system. And if you want to see when this happens for real is, gee, on the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan, we figured out painfully how to fuse, you know, intelligence and find, fix, and finish and things we couldn't do inside the building when you know, what was important was process and procedure. We tend to kind of rise to the occasion when necessary, painfully, we eventually do the right thing. What we don't recognize is then when that activity is over, the bureaucracy collapses and takes it in again. What we need is to institutionalize those things. And this time to, as I said, I just want to keep hammering at this, expand our way to kind of embrace all the technologies we no longer own and are not leading. And what I mean by that is, no, Google or some of your favorite startup is not going to build a weapon system, but there is Common Core and open source and 5,000 other things that will get us to 90% of where we need to go. And then all of a sudden, the DoD and its primes and its FFRDCs ought to be focused on building the exquisite pointy ends, whether they're sensors or kinetic effects or something else. And just the same, well, we don't need to build the next 500 drones or, gee, you know, autonomous navigation or whatever. I mean, that's been solved 15 times before. How many times do we need to repay primes to kind of build the same, you know, physical structures or nav or whatever? And if we start thinking about it, we could then build standard and create tech ecosystems around specific DoD needs, build stacks of off-the-shelf, you know, commodity things that commoditize 90% and allow us to focus on the things that are important. But I have to tell you, half the problem is thinking about this. I'm just stunned about how few in the DoD could do two things. One is go up to a whiteboard and just show me how startups, and more importantly, their investors, the venture capitalists, make money. Draw me that diagram and compare it to how we do acquisition. First of all, you'd be surprised how few people could do that, because if you did, you would understand why most commercial companies don't, other than the ones designed to do that, don't want to work with the DoD. It has nothing to do with, you know, we hate the military. It's just that the military is not designed. It's simply just not designed. It's not like, let's make it kind of better, which we have done. But no, it's just there isn't a design. The second activity is, good, I want you all guys who are working on requirements and programs, et cetera, go up to the whiteboard and draw me how China's, you know, done their defense acquisition requirement systems in the last 10 years and how they've been generating these generations of ships and planes and whatever, and compare it to ours. What's different here? And don't tell me it's just money. Assume we had the money. Well, what would you do? We're kind of locked into this model, and it's normal human nature, and it's how you manage large companies and agencies, and the DoD is the largest in the world, 2 million people. you know, you build these processes and procedures and networks, and people come to work to do their job and they follow, you know, this authority or this whatever, and you get locked into that. But when the world changes, you need to step back and go, huh, at the highest level, what do we need? And you might come down to say, well, we don't have the authority to do that. Great. Let's go to Congress, start with the House and Senate Armed Services Committee, start with the staffers and point out to them is here's where we are and here's where we need to go. And these are the authorities we need. And maybe you won't get them, but at least now you've been able to articulate where do we want to head to kind of change the world here of the one we're living in. Because the other piece of this, by the way, I've been focused on tech. I don't have to tell your audience. The problem is you know, and this tech would be irrelevant if the threats haven't changed. I mean, if the threats were constant, that would just be fine. But we're no longer setting the pace of what the threats are. Our adversaries, certainly China and Russia and some others, have, you know, the capability to kind of remove our exquisite assets in space overnight, kinetically and non-kinetically. Certainly, you know, it's pretty clear on what's publicly acknowledged what could happen to our own infrastructure, both commercial and military, with cyber attacks. You could go down the list. Those threats that we planned for even 10 years ago, you know, have changed rapidly. And nations that we couldn't even think to threaten our assets, like Iran, you know, North Korea and others, now have capabilities that, you know, were just unimaginable with ICBMs and the cyber threats and again, threats to things on under the water and in space. So the threat environment has changed and will continue to change as these technologies are now available to everybody. And not only available to everybody, our adversaries are selling them to everybody. You know, we try to put our thumb on nuclear proliferation in the 50s, 60s, 70s, did a pretty good job. But now we have weapon systems proliferation at a size and scale that's unimaginable. I mean, just look at what happened to Armenia and the use of drones. I mean, just watching those videos, you got to ask yourself, could we do the same to an adversary at scale today, or will it be done to us? And those systems are now just available in the marketplace. You know, I hate to be a tanker or someone on the ground, just watching those drone attacks.
Well, let me ask you about China, right? I mean, so there is this proliferation of technology, which, you know, we've known for a long time, right? I mean, we knew these technologies were going to be used against us. And in the case of China, its best and brightest have gone to school for the last 50 years in the best universities around the world. They've run Western cutting edge businesses. They've gone home and run divisions at home. And now they work for Chinese state companies the Chinese innovation enterprise. At the same time, the Chinese capital is all around the world. I've met startups in Africa. I've met startups in Asia. I've met startups in the United States, even at the small level that include Chinese venture capital in it. How, you know, the last administration's focus was somehow that we could cut the Chinese off and we could compel our allies to cut them off and that we could somehow compel financial markets to cut them off. How much capabilities does China, Steve, have now to develop on its own, even if we try to cut all of these cords?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, one of the things we stood up with CFIUS, you know, our ability to kind of manage and monitor foreign investments in key technology companies. I think we could use, rather than an axe, maybe a scalpel. I'd be happy to take Chinese money as long as all it is their money. The problem wasn't their money. The problem was it gave them access to technology and source code and insights and ideas and whatever. So, you know, if you want to be a little more subtle, great. You want to be investors? Perfect. You have no voting rights. You have no access to the tech. You have no board seats. And by the way, we're not putting our servers in China. But if you want to invest, great. And by the way, you have no voting rights, so you can't control the company. You know, that's fine. I think that the real subtle issue was this, you know, basically it gave them a sensor system, a sensor network of being able to sense all the trends and all the technology. And, you know, on the next level, they were stealing things that were, you know, that weren't tied down. And lots of things that were tied down were just being, you know, I mean, they made the Russians look dumb. I mean, while the Russians were stealing things, stealing us blind during the Cold War, the Chinese automated the system. And by the way, this is one reason the Chinese were able to apply all these new developments so rapidly. They skipped the basic research step. It doesn't mean China doesn't have great researchers, but they basically took the outputs of all our R&D labs and all our university labs and said, great, okay, research is done. Now let's build on it. Well, we spent the first, 10, 20 years funding all that research. We shouldn't just point to the Chinese. It's what the Americans did to the British in the 18th century and 19th century, et cetera. But it is a fact. It's what the Soviets did to us in the 40s and 50s and 60s is stole our basic research and some of the results of our applied research and said, oh, that's possible. You can build an atomic bomb. So we skip the theory part. Let's just figure out what the applied part was. Doesn't mean they didn't have smart people who couldn't have done it. It's just that we shortcutted the process. Same happened with China. So back to answering your question. So, there's a difference between Chinese money and the Chinese taking assets and talent. I mean, they had the Thousand Talents program and they were basically exfiltrating Chinese expats back home. All rational things for them to do. And, we were just sitting here, focused on how profitable it was to have our factories in China. I think in the last 4 or 5 years, and certainly under this administration now, we've kind of come to the conclusion that that wasn't a good idea and we'll be smarter about it. I think today's announcement about supply chain and putting semiconductor fabs in the U.S. Is a realization that that some of these are really strategic assets of the United States that we need to protect and that we need to make sure we have our domestic supply for them. Semiconductors happen to be a favorite of mine. I was in two semiconductor startups and sit on the advisory board for Applied Materials, but I think, we should remember unexpected consequences as we not only build up our internal capability and for semiconductors, this is not a cheap program. Cutting off supply of this equipment to Chinese manufacturers will certainly be on a short term, probably a good idea, but in the long term, they'll just develop an indigenous ability to manufacture that equipment themselves that they'll certainly put out on a commercial market and start undercutting U.S. manufacturers. That's probably a decade off. But you have to predict that this is not a checkers game, but it's a long-term chess game. So I don't know if that answers your question. Or a go game. Probably more of a go game, which Americans are not particularly good at. But that's why I use the chess analogy is you got to look multiple plies deep. And we're usually very bad at looking at blowback. That is the consequence of X and Y, using social media during Arab Spring to foment revolutions in Arab countries. What a great idea. or using it to kind of, make Putin on edge and guess what? Somebody used that back to us in 2016 and continues to do that much more effectively than perhaps we even did. So you need to sometimes think about the consequences of each one of these moves about, what will happen, what can we do to mitigate that? And sometimes you will take those short-term successes and kick the can down the road.
Where do you think, Steve, right? I mean, when you look at the Chinese ecosystem on autonomy, AI, and even on quantum, you begin to realize that actually, when we talk about near peer, there's always a tendency of thinking of the Chinese as the near peer, as opposed to us, their near peer, and that they may actually be ahead of us. In what technology areas would you say that there's a danger that they're ahead? And what sort of national approach do we need to become more competitive at it? Because there's this tendency of people to say, the government doesn't get anything right and, shouldn't be in the business of picking winners and losers. And the government is always in the position of picking winners and losers. When it picks right. Lockheed over Boeing, it's picked a winner over a loser, right? Where is China in the lead? And what are the things that the government realistically can do to spur greater competitiveness on the part of the United States in those areas?
It's funny you mentioned that. Yesterday, that is February 23rd, 2021, Eric Schmidt and Brad Smith, head of Microsoft, testified in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee literally articulating some of those key issues. And you know, Eric's favorite is AI and quantum, and I think he's right. You know, those are two areas that China has made massive investments, and in some cases, at least for what's publicly available, our peer or maybe even further in terms of investment. AI is one that, AI is going to be like the cloud. It will be distributed in every weapon system and every decision support system we do. We were smart enough to stand up the JAIC, the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center. Eric made some recommendations that it ought to be a 3-star with even more authority because of its importance. And I think there are other areas like that. We've talked about semiconductors. China has now invested $100 billion, $100 billion, to build an indigenous semiconductor infrastructure, both for fabs, but also for the equipment, for electronic design, automation, software, the entire ecosystem, and they're being successful. To kind of counter those with our own investments requires us to, again, not think of them as DOD-only investments, but investments in the commercial ecosystem that could be dual use to build what I keep going back to, this civil-military alliance that allows us to kind of take advantage of the fact that, you know, in the United States, there's about $150 billion a year, $150 billion a year invested in technology startups, in both life sciences and hardware and software, et cetera. We really have not figured out how to give incentives to those companies to also figure out how to sell to the DoD, because we haven't thought of them as integral parts of our system. So I'm circling back to the, you know, China has kind of, we talk about China's civil-military fusion like it's a, you know, successful integrated top-to-bottom program. It is kind of one of their goals. We still have the ability to build our version of this much bigger and better. But we need to realize that we need to get going.
Let me ask you two questions. One is, what are some good examples from your standpoint, right? I mean, military people always like examples, you know, good examples of successful strategy, good example of failed strategy, right? To help shape their thinking. What's a good strategy worth emulating? What's a bad one that's a good, hairy, cautionary tale?
You know, I'll take some halfway in between. So the one I'm most familiar with is, the Army's Rapid Equipping Forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. With a small group of 120 people, it deployed hundreds of solutions to the battlefield. You mentioned nuclear weapons in 2.5 years in World War II. These weren't nuclear weapons, but they enabled a lot of people to get home in one piece with their some of the other activities that, and as I said, basically, we kind of lost that capability when we no longer had a crisis. Just as an aside, large organizations tend to innovate well under a crisis and or a leadership change. And then when there's no crisis, they default to their natural state, not bad, right, but their natural state, which is process, procedure, execution. Here's how we've always done it. I come to work 9 to 5 and I get to go home. The other thing we've been doing well is, but again, partial success, is NavalX, AFWERX, SouthWERX. You know, there must be 60, 70, maybe more incubators and accelerators across the DoD. The good news is, we're shaping innovation culture, and we're now providing homes for the large percentage of young service people and DoD employees who know what GitHub and Stack Exchange and Read Hacker News are, and finally finding a way to kind of build an ambidextrous organization that allows us to execute and innovate. But of course, we now acknowledge that there's the classic ditch of death is, you know, I figured out how to give them a SIBR or maybe managed to get them an OTA, but how many of them have actually become programs of record? Oops. Well, we haven't connected. So the good news is, you know, we're getting there. The bad news is we haven't figured out how to integrate it into this system, because as I said, we don't have a system for this. We have a system to do the classic PBE and requirements and acquisition, and this stuff doesn't fit. And this is where I go, don't screw with that one. Just build a parallel one that takes all this output and says, no, we're going to deploy this in a test squadron. Or, I mean, we used to know how to do this stuff. And no, you know, like it'll be a different strike group. And no, because what eventually happens is innovation starts at the edges. And when it's successful through Darwinian processes, becomes the core. But if the core is a set of rent seekers who don't want innovation to replace them, then you have these kind of, you know, battles of, you know, moving from cavalry to, you know, armor, from moving from, you know, battleships to aircraft carrier. I mean, we go through this every generation. But now we're doing it in the face of an adversary that doesn't have these barriers. Big idea. China didn't have much of a legacy system of technology innovation. So our advanced systems that we built in the 20th century and then we built in the last 20 years to compete with non-nation states is actually an albatross. And again, not because of malice or bad thinking or whatever, but we have to support all the system. What do we do with all that stuff? China didn't start with that. And Russia, almost the same. I mean, out of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the rubble of the Yeltsin years, you know, Putin basically said, look, I'm going to restart over for certainly our strategic systems. If you look at what they've done in mobile ICBMs and their things in space and building special forces and hybrid warfare on to kind of take advantage of the few strengths that they have and the physical locations where they were, but they did a damn good job. You know, we last 4 years, we spent their time focused on the South China Sea. You know, we're going to start paying attention to the Kaliningrad corridor and the Polish border again, because those are equally at risk. And this, we're going to obviously now start recognizing we could never have won a war in the 21st century without allies. But now it's pretty clear in either one of these contested areas, and certainly the Middle East as well. We allies are essential, not just for positioning equipment, and that means new allies as well as reinforcing our old ones. And the last part, and again, I'm sorry to digress, but you know, we've been talking about military systems, but you know, a nation's power is not just its military. It's this whole phrase called DIME. You know, it's diplomatic strength, it's intelligence and information capabilities, it's military strength, and it's economic strength. And if you plot that over the last 500 years, you know, the last 75 has been our time. And most nations who decline because, you know, they lose a war or lose allies or decline in economic power or, you know, lose interest in world affairs. And there's only been one nation in 500 years that actually managed to come back again and from that decline, and that's been China. And their trend line is intercepting ours. And given what's happened to the Uyghurs and Hong Kong and Tibet, I don't think that bodes well for freedom and democracy across the world. And I think it's up to us, everybody listening, to figure out is how do we become more adaptable? How do we become more agile? How do we take what we know we're capable of doing and do it again? I think we can. I think we have the smartest people in the world that don't work for startups. They work in the DOD. I've met with them and I've seen them and they serve their country. And we just need to figure out how to organize to do that.
Silicon Valley in 1978 was a very, very different place. And it seems like it was a lot less contrived than it is today, right? I mean, today people, you know, it's sort of like a joke almost, right? But it's people who tell you to put the mayonnaise in, you know, with the tuna fish, you know, you got to put the peanut butter, you know, the jelly on the peanut butter, as opposed to back then, which was a very, very different environment, right? What can people learn from Silicon Valley circa 1978 that would hold us in good stead today and beyond?
Well, you know, Silicon Valley is kind of followed what happened to Hollywood. you know, in the early part of the 20th century, people who were making short films fled the East Coast because Thomas Edison owned the patents on moving cameras and had kind of a, he was one of the first patent trolls along with Kodak. And those, seriously, and the movie folks figured out the best place to avoid the lawyers were to move all the way to the West Coast, where it took days to get a lawyer out there. And they found this.
So you're saying to get away from Route 128, everybody went to California?
It's not a bad thesis, and I'll come back to that in a second. And so the analogy was, and there was no lawyers, there was no PR, there was no whatever. It was like a community making films. And then eventually the hangers-on showed up and the lawyers showed up and they started giving themselves awards, like the Oscars started in the 1920s, but they had been in business for 10 or 15 years earlier. And the same thing happened in Silicon Valley. In Silicon Valley was a bunch of nerds making technology for each other. There were no consumer products. You were selling transistors to, you know, other computer companies or defense companies. It started out as a microwave valley and then became a semiconductor valley. These were very technical products. When companies started going public and then we started making computers for individuals, personal computers, Apple and then IBM and others, all of a sudden the rest of the United States kind of understood there was a place that was kind of interesting. But early on, it was when I came out, it was a defense valley. And then, as I said, a semiconductor valley. I was lucky enough to work in both of those early segments before I moved into other areas. The other thing that was interesting, and this was my contribution, is that for the first 25 years, from about 1975 to 2000, the investors, that is the people who actually fund entrepreneurs, the venture capitalists, essentially said, without ever saying these exact words, is, startups, you're nothing more than smaller versions of large companies. So we want you to use the method that large companies do. They write five-year plans. We want you to predict the future. They hire, you know, executives on day one, sales, marketing, business development, engineering. We want you to do that. And more importantly, they specify the product with all the features and then they ship it. And that's it. We're funding you to ship the product as exactly as you told us you're going to build. Never even thinking that you might want to get some customer feedback. And most of those startups failed, but enough of them made money that that's how VCs did it. And my contribution and the one that changed my work, Eric Ries's work and Alexander Osterwalder's work said, wait a minute, startups aren't small versions of companies at all. Startups, large companies execute known business models, which is a fancy word for saying, listen, you become large because you finally figure out through trial and error who your customer is, you know, what features they want, how to price it, who your competitors are, et cetera. But when you're a startup, you know, you're not executing anything. You're searching for a business model. And we had built 100 years of tools for execution, but we had built no tools for search because we didn't think they were different. And so my work kicked off what's called this lean startup movement, which said, No. What you need to do is assume on day one is all you have is a set of untested hypotheses. All the meaning you're just effing guessing. So why don't we build a methodology to get out of the building and as early as possible kind of test some of our assumptions, both business assumptions about, you know, customers and pricing, et cetera. And then let's start building products with a methodology that didn't exist in the 20th century called agile engineering, where we could build products iteratively and incrementally and figure out whether we have something called product market fit, whether we have found the fit between the customers and early product way before we launch and ship it and, you know, put the Ford class carrier and the elevators and the and the launch system in the water. Maybe we should build, you know, minimum viable products. And if they're wrong, instead of firing people, if we discover this early on, we could do something which makes us look like a blur to our competitors. And that's this idea called a pivot. And a pivot says, listen, when you get new data early on that your customers are the wrong customers or you're building the wrong thing for the right customers, change. It's okay. You're a startup. You have permission to change because if you don't change, you're going to find out this much later and you're just going to burn a lot of cash and waste a lot of time and go out of business. So why don't we change now? And all of a sudden, an investor said, well, yeah, okay, even though you sold us on idea X or Y, you now have evidence. So this is an evidence-based methodology that people would rather buy X versus Y. Sure, we'll take that. Go change. And sometimes it requires change of technology or change of sales strategy or change of sometimes people.
but you kind of learn rapidly. And that's basically, if you think about it, I accidentally reinvented the OODA loop, you know, for startups. And this lean methodology is essentially how startups and innovation happens across the world now. But it took some pattern recognition to kind of understand that maybe the common wisdom of how we did this was just wrong. And I had the luxury of doing this because I retired after doing 8 startups in a row and you know, hit the luckiest man in the world jackpot in the last internet bubble at the turn of the century, and had the time and luxury of sitting at Stanford and Berkeley teaching to start thinking about these patterns. So that's the answer. The same thing happened when I met Pete Newell and Joe Filter. And we started talking about some of the classes I had built for the National Science Foundation called the I-Corps, of whether we could adapt and adopt them to serve the Department of Defense and Intelligence community. And what came out of that is this program called Hacking for Defense, which is now run by DIU in 50 plus universities and is now in UK and Australia and will be in some of the other Five Eyes. We just stood up Hacking for Allies, and there are variants of this you know, Hacking for Oceans and Scripps and UC Santa Cruz, et cetera. But those just came from pattern recognition and also circles back to my my desire to have my students do some form of national service. Students who never would have considered the DOD or IC as part of their career paths, and certainly the research universities they're at, or never had been exposed to the government at all. And we have found that the attach rate of students who had never had any interest post-class turns out to be over 40% who kind of still keep engaged with the DOD. And it's just a small program, but one could imagine at scale some form of national service that didn't actually require a draft, but required engagement. And I think we would be surprised how amenable and how successful that would be.
Let me ask you a last question. You're a proud United States Air Force veteran, Vietnam veteran. You were working on AC-130 gunships operating from Thailand, as well as a number of other airplanes like A-7s and F-4s and you name it.
And wild weasels.
Exactly. Were they still F-105s at the time you were
working
for?
They were F-105s. Yep.
Outstanding. Chuck Horner was one of the pioneers of that community, flying the F-105 both in a strike capacity, but also in the Wild Weasel mission, which was exceptionally dangerous. So what did you learn, right? I mean, what are the lasting lessons? Because, you know, after Vietnam is when you went to Silicon Valley, where Bill Perry at ESL was, you know, your first company there you worked for was ESL, Electronic Systems Laboratory. What did you learn from the Air Force?
I was pretty young. I guess I joined the military at 18 and volunteered for war zone. So I was both young and maybe naive and slightly stupid, but I always had this notion, and I still have it, is that, and I couldn't articulate it at the time, but, you know, my parents were immigrants. They fled the Holocaust. And I always thought that we are only here for a short period of time. And we all should have, in our own way, some notion of service, whether it's to God or country or community or family. And I've tried to live my life doing that, is to serve some of them at different times, and some well, some better than others. You know, my experience in Thailand and Southeast Asia during the quiet part of a war zone was seeing a bunch of dedicated people trying to serve their country. Some of them efficiently and some of them not. You know, personally, it's where I first learned. I had two skills, and it's the only two skills I've had. And it's the one that got me through a career in the military and the Air and Silicon Valley, was that I was able to assimilate a lot of data in a short period of time. And then the other part, which actually helped me create the Lean Startup Method and startups themselves, was pattern recognition skills, being able to look at all this data. And while other people saw a lot of data or confusing systems or whatever, kind of figuring out is, well, this is complex, but it's not NP complete, meaning it's not computational unsolvable, that you could figure it out. And then you could maybe see things that other people don't. And that's part of this conversation is, you know, I'm not pointing out things that
people don't already know. I think people see parts of this puzzle at all. And I think there have been some incredibly smart and great suggestions that have moved the ball forward. You know, the work of the Defense Innovation Board has been spectacular. And you know, Eric Schmidt and groups like him, and Josh Marcuse, who was the executive director, Defense Business Board, which I sat on, had some incredibly smart and deeply knowledgeable people, Defense Science Board. I mean, the service boards, all the folks inside who are thinking through this problem. But I think, as I said, we need to go all the way to the top and go, maybe we're not understanding that the world's changed and that we're trying to make an old model fit into a new one. So that's my answer. And I guess I would go back to what I learned is at the end of the day, you have to serve somebody. And this conversation is just part of my attempt in trying to serve my country.
Steve, thanks so much for spending so much time with us. I mean, it's an absolute pleasure talking to you. You're welcome on anytime. Would love to do a second version of this because we didn't get to hacking for defense, but we hope Pete Newell is going to be joining us and talking to us about that next week. Thank you very, very much.
You're doing God's work here. So,
well, thank you very much. I mean, the feeling is very mutual.